Good morning. Happy Monday if you're not a Toronto Blue Jays fan. Absolute disaster Monday. We can rally everyone up. Bad weekend for the Toronto Blue Jays. Fun weekend in general. How are you doing, Julia? This is Jays Talk Plus, by the way.
This is Jays Talk Plus. I'm Julia Kurtz. This is Blake Murphy. And it's definitely a Monday morning. I'm okay, Blake. I mean, it was a busy weekend for sure. There was a lot going on. Not a ton of good baseball to talk about, but we still found ways to be happy at the ballpark. Not the least of which, Family Day. Family Day at the ballpark. Can you tell me about that experience,
please? I can. So the Toronto Blue Jays allowed us on Saturday as media to bring family members along with us. So I brought my mom and stepdad. They got to tour the Rogers Center a little bit. They got to sit in on John Schneider's pregame press conference, got to come watch batting practice on the field. It was cool. So my mom is not a baseball fan, but the like getting to be there stuff and see the guys up close was cool. My stepdad is a baseball fan. And then it was a good game. I think if it had been a bad game, they would have started doing the very suburban. So they come in from about 2 hours out of town. They would have done the very suburban, like, can we beat the Gardner traffic if we leave in the, like, if it was like 10-0 in the sixth inning, they were out of there for sure.
Yeah.
But it was great. I really thankful for the Blue Jays to let us do that. Got to meet some of our colleagues, partners or parents or kids or brothers. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a good time. I didn't have anyone there because Maxine's out of town, but I did feel like it was just like a family event in which like people, you know, were rallying kind of around those who didn't have anyone there and making us feel a little more included in things like that.
You got to meet my mom.
Your mom was one of those people, and it was really, really awesome to sort of understand better where this comes from. I do feel like I have a better grasp on Blake Murphy, and honestly, she's great. She's funny and super, you know, just inviting, polite. It was a fun time. I know that she is probably also listening.
Well, she's probably like listening, but like watching one of my nephews and like hoping he falls asleep to the sounds of my voice.
I promise I didn't.
She was very eager to tell everyone that like my youngest nephew falls asleep like 10 minutes into the show every time. He's only 1.5, so it's a good thing. It's a positive that he falls asleep. But she was very eager to tell people that. It was really fun. It was really nice of the Jays to do that. As I understand it, I did a better job being social with other people than I did at Keegan's book lunch. So that's nice. It was also, so we will talk about the baseball stuff, but it was also Pride Night on Friday.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine who covers baseball nationally had texted me after our show on Friday and said that in her experience, and she had been to, you know, a handful of Pride Nights around baseball, the Blue Jays were one of the orgs that did it pretty well. Now, this was referring to the Pride Nights from prior to the last 2 years. I thought, you know, we've talked about 2024 was, I was fairly critical of them on the air. It just like there wasn't much going on and it's felt short notice and things like that. 2023, obviously the Anthony Bass stuff kind of hung over everything. But this year seemed a lot more prepared, a lot more meat to the event. I didn't go on Friday. I was at a concert, but how was your experience at Pride Night on Friday?
I would agree with that. I think it was, there was a lot going on, a lot of good things going on beyond even, you know, activations around the ballpark or whatever. You know, there was still actual content that was produced by the Blue Jays in order to, you know, to play on the big screen. And those things, they kind of matter just as much as the fun stuff that's happening around the ballpark and things like that, because you kind of also need to pair that with just a level of consciousness and understanding of where we are and how far we've come. And so that was pretty well done, and I agree with you that it was perhaps a little bit better than what we've seen in, you know, the past couple of years. The one bone I have to pick with the Blue Jays and with ballpark ops, perhaps, we got to update the playlist. Like, I understand that, like, you know, historically Madonna plays and ABBA, perhaps a little bit of Queen here and there. Sure. But like, if you want to attract like a, you know, a younger audience or whatever, let's get with the times.
So, in the interest of not talking about the awful loss to the White Sox yesterday, let's do it. Let's build the playlist for 2026. Like, are we talking like we're getting some Renee rap on there?
Yes,
what are we? Okay,
exactly.
Okay, so they didn't play YMCA, did they?
Yes, they did.
That one's tough because not only is it outdated, it has been co-opted by people who very much do not believe in LGBTQ causes.
I know. Like, I understand. It's you know, it is fun to stay at the YMCA, and it is even more fun to do the dance like at the ballpark with when, you know, the camera may find you or whatever. Sure. But, you know, Hot to Go is here. There's also a dance to that. If if that's the point that you're trying to make here. Yeah, I don't know.
Did we get some Pink Pony Club? Did we get that too?
That was the one that played. And yeah, I mean, if you're going to do a Chapel Roan song these days, I guess that's
you want one that people like know and can sing along to a little bit, right? So so that's good. It was also, should mention, it was National Indigenous Peoples Day on Saturday as well. So the Blue Jays did some stuff before the game. And then Jace Martin, who is an Indigenous person, did the national anthems. There was a pitcher from the Jays Care Foundation's Indigenous Rookie League who threw out the first pitch on Saturday as well. The Jays Care Foundation, I know, does a lot of stuff with Indigenous communities throughout Canada. But yeah, wanted to mention that because we didn't mention it on Friday. And last thing from me, I promise, before we actually talk about the games. By the way, we're going to take your text today as well. So text us to 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. But throughout this first hour especially, we'll answer some of your questions. We had a bunch left over from the end of last week as well. So fire away, 590-590. A congratulations to noted Blue Jays fan. And I hope Jays Talk Plus this, or Shea Gilgeous-Alexander on the NBA championship. So Shea is like a legitimate Blue Jays fan. I don't know if Lou Dort is a Blue Jays fan or not, the other Canadian on OKC. But yeah, shout out to Shea. He has mentioned the Blue Jays a lot in the past and sometimes unprompted. So big Jays fan. We need a Shea Gilgeous-Alexander first pitch.
I was going to say, speaking of first pitches, I don't think that hasn't happened yet, right, at any point?
Shea doing it? I mean, I don't know about in the past, but certainly not this season.
Nice. Well, something to look forward to. And congrats. That was big. Congrats to my brother, too. An OKC fan for a long time who has suffered a lot at the hands of this team, finally getting some joy here with Game 7 going.
So, I hope J.D. Bunkus is not listening, because what he would say to that is, so J.D. grew up a Sonics fan because he grew up in the UConn, and that was a Pacific Northwest team.
Right.
He would say that your brother cannot claim suffering for a team that was stolen from another fan base. You know, I'm sure your brother didn't root for them because they got stolen from Seattle. He's like, basketball colonialism.
It was mostly, he was really a big fan of Russell Westbrook. That's where Westbrook played for a long time. And, you know, Westbrook left, but the fandom remained. Listen, I'll pass along J.D. Bunks's opinion. I don't think my brother will care that much, to be honest with
you. Probably not. Probably not. All right, let's talk about the baseball. The reason we have done 7 or 8 minutes, I mean, the Pride stuff is important. The Indigenous Peoples Day stuff is important. But the primary reason we're delaying here is the Blue Jays had a really bad series against the Chicago White Sox.
We are avoiding dealing with what happened.
For anyone who missed it, 7-1 loss on Friday. Bullpen day versus bullpen day. We had set up Davis Martin as the starter, and then he was a late scratch. So Spencer Turnbull led a bullpen day on the Blue Jays side against a bullpen day on the White Sox side. It did not go well for the Toronto Blue Jays, only 9 base runners. That's not a good White Sox bullpen. It's not one of these like bad teams that has sneaky great arms at the back end. It just a pretty disappointing day offensively. Pretty disappointing start for Spencer Turnbull and Mason Flaherty too. But anytime you only put up one run against the other team's bullpen day, I'm like, whatever. Spencer Turnbull and Mason Flaherty could have pitched better and probably should have navigated the White Sox lineup a little better. But you put a one up against a bullpen day, ugly.
I wish I had thought of this, I don't know, 2 hours ago, but I am curious to sort of dig into the numbers of how the Blue Jays do against bullpen days, because it feels like we have had this conversation before.
Yes, and so I have been asked about this on Twitter before, that and like position players pitching and stuff like that, because it felt like the Jays have had a lot of that in games as well. The hard thing about an opener is like there's no like smooth way to query it because like it could be a bad start. It could be, so I have to... Right. I will have to go through game by game, and I'm not going to be able to contextualize it like league wide. Yeah. Like there's no like tab of like when an opener starts. So I'll have to just like kind of hand bomb it. Please don't make me do that unless they have a, let's not do it for the White Sox. If a good team bullpen days them again.
Are you talking to me or the audience?
Everyone.
You say, please don't make me do that.
Don't make me pull the data on that. That's not a clean way to do that.
I think the one that I'm thinking about is, that game against the Rangers in which
Jacob Latz
left early.
Yes, injured.
And it became a bullpen day.
Yeah, so Jacob Latz went 3 shutout against them.
Yeah, and that was not great either. And later you kind of have John Schneider saying things like, well, we weren't really expecting a bullpen day. And when you're seeing a different arm every inning or whatever, it makes things a little bit difficult.
And in both of these cases, they were not expecting a bullpen day. But I still think... Yeah, I mean, especially in the case of the Rangers, like I would rather face Jacob Latz on short notice than Nate Eovaldi with prep, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, so that was Friday. Saturday rolls around. The complete opposite. They win 7-1, get a lot of offense early on. Aaron Civale wasn't particularly good. Jose Brios gives them terrific length, takes it into the eighth inning, the same night of his La Maquina Foundation charity event, which apparently went very, very well and raised 6 figures for his foundation there as well. Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. both hit home runs. 4 other players have multi-hit games. We have our families there. Me and my mom are on the broadcast.
Nothing can go wrong ever again.
Yes. And then Sunday rolls around, and the Jays are struggling offensively again, getting lots of base runners, but not effectively scoring them. A couple of outs on the base paths, on the contact play with, I think they were both with runners on the corner, but a couple of, I guess not mistakes, because if you get the call to go, you go, but a couple of outs on the base paths, which you never like to see, some ineffectiveness with runners in scoring position. And then they take a 2-1 lead into the bullpen part. So this is where we'll kind of discuss this game a little more deeply. I want to note, because it raised my eyebrows, that Chris Bassett came out after 6 innings and 82 pitches.
Right.
So the bullpen was fairly well rested. It is an off day Monday. I would understand even if they had taken him out there because our 3 leverage arms are ready to go. This isn't the greatest offense. You know, we want to save Bassett a little bit. I don't like that. Mm-hmm. I've talked about this before. I don't love the trend of like babying starting pitchers that has happened over the last decade or so. I would have liked Bassett out there. However, important context here, if you were mad at that, Bassett said after the game, he kind of self-excluded. Mm-hmm. He went to Schneider and said between the heat, he had been feeling a little under the weather. His legs didn't feel all that strong. This was as much a Bassett call as anything. Mm-hmm. And then what happens from there is not great.
Yeah, not a good day to feel under the weather. Blue Jays really needed Chris Bassett's dominance, I feel, for a little bit longer in the way that it went.
Yeah, and like, look, you give up 1 run over 6 innings, you still did your job. Yeah,
absolutely.
It just, and if you're John Schneider, you feel okay about Yariel Rodriguez, Brendan Little, and Jeff Hoffman are all available.
Right.
Yariel Rodriguez gives them a very good 7th inning, but then Brendan Little gets into trouble. Jeff Hoffman can't field an infield ground ball cleanly. It leads to a big inning of 3 unearned runs, although the error was Hoffman, and you believe that should still get charged to him.
It should still count. I mean, not the tying run, of course, because the base runner was still Brendan Little's name there. But the base runners that are Hoffman's should be earned runs. That's, I guess, my opinion. That rule is never going to change, probably, but, you know, you're still responsible for what happened there.
Yes. So they, between Little and Hoffman, 0 earnies, 3 Berts, unearned runs there. So this is, look, even without those being earned runs, some flags in Jeff Hoffman's profile at this point, and not, like, under the hood, there's not a ton off. It's not like a big velocity dip or a big spin rate dip or anything like that. But even with those runs being unearned, 5.29 ERA right now, a 3.50 expected ERA, which isn't as bad as the service ERA, but it's still not like top-end closer kind of stuff. He's walked, you know, an average amount of guys. And that one, I know it was like mostly an error. It wasn't like he was getting hammered all over the ballpark, but it's happened a few times now. And you had brought this up on the show last week, I think, like a bit of a... not discomfort, but you could phrase it however you want to phrase it in terms of how you felt about Jeff Hoffman. But this is 4 blown saves now in 21 opportunities for Jeff Hoffman. Not the worst conversion rate, but how are you feeling about Hoffman today?
Yeah, it is weird because if you look at, you know, even the contact, even the double, it was not hard hit. The pitch was, it was a slider that didn't land in the zone. It was low. It wasn't a terrible pitch. It's just that there always seems to be traffic. And listen, this is just the eye test, but it does feel like there's a walk in there, or there is, you know, a soft single that kind of sheds a little bit of, or casts a bit of doubt on what Hoffman can do and how he's going to get out of it and stuff like that. The dominance that we saw in the first month of the season, we haven't seen since. And it's very touch and go. It's very up and down. You don't really know what version of Jeff Hoffman you are going to see on any given day. And that's what's concerning, right? I understand that the Blue Jays may not be the best team for a closer to get into any sort of rhythm, because there have been a few blowouts on each side for a while now. Like, I understand that, but at some point you have to kind of just do your job there,
yeah, right? And the rhythm thing is, like, it's real. You don't want to sit for too long, but you can, I guess, but there's an incongruity in, like, the excuse last time being he's pitched a little too much, and now it's he's not pitching enough. It's like, okay, he's gonna pitch every 2.5 days, like, right. and that's the way. So it's tough. And you mentioned the walk. So Chase Medroth, who walks to load the bases initially, like, only one of those pitches, he actually got a freebie.
Yep.
The first pitch of that plate appearance was absolutely not even close to a strike, and it was a called strike. So he got ahead on a freebie, and then nothing else was really close. Mm-hmm. Even the Benintendi, like, I get it, he got him in at the hands and chopped it, but, like, you got two strikes, you're way ahead in the count. The Vargas one, like you said, it's a slider below the zone, but he had multiple opportunities. Like, he fouled
off, like, three pitches.
Yeah, it was 0-2 immediately, and then just couldn't put him away. Which, you know, that's kind of what you're trying to do if you're that's what you're expected to do if you're Jeff Hoffman in that situation.
What do you sort of see? You know, I know we spoke about this before the show a little bit, but the splitter doesn't seem to be extremely effective right now. It doesn't seem like it's doing its job the way that it's supposed to, and the way that, again, we saw earlier in the season. But for me, I still look at, and the slider may be working a bit better in terms of shape and things like that, but for me, it does start with the fastball, and the fact that, listen, it's a good fastball, but you still need to locate it, and you still need to be able to throw it for strikes to get ahead of hitters. That is what Hoffman was doing so well early in the season. Is that something that is, you know, within the realm of reality?
Yeah, and it's one of those weird ones where, you know, the pitch design metrics still really like his fastball. It grades out as a pretty well above average one, but the location on it is just not where it needs to be. Like yesterday, he threw that 10 times, and he got six swings, and they fouled every one of them off. So they're not squaring anything up. They're not getting good contact on it, but you're not tricking anyone, and you got zero called strikes with it. If it was a strike, they knew it was a strike. So similar to what we talked about with Gausman's struggle last start, it seems a little bit the pinpoint isn't there. And Hoffman doesn't need to be a pinpoint guy. Like, the slider and splitter are so nasty when he's on that I've talked to him about this before. It's like, yeah, ideally the splitter drops out of the zone or in at the hands of a righty or something like that. But the stuff is so good that when he's on, he doesn't really need to nibble. He can throw the slider and the splitter in the zone. But the fastball is more of a nibble thing, because if that's what you're sitting on, if you're the White Sox, and if you were going up against Jeff Hoffman, you're probably looking for the fastball because the splitter and slider are so tough. But even a team like the White Sox, that is one of the worst hitting teams in all of baseball, didn't swing at a single one that wasn't off the plate and swung at every single one that was on the plate. So, you know, maybe it's a sequencing issue. Maybe it's a pinpoint precision issue. But yeah, the results haven't quite been there on the fastball, despite, again, the pitch design metrics thinking it's a quality pitch. Really, you know, the slider has been where he's been most effective this year from a results perspective. And then the splitter is an interesting one, because we've talked about splitters a lot this year because Gausman has been on and off with it. Bowden Francis kind of lost his. But Hoffman's is so different. He throws his like 91, and he throws his as a fastball. He wants that left-right movement that we've talked about Gausman doesn't really want. So it's like you almost have to treat it like a different pitch when we're talking about it versus a Gausman-style splitter. Anyway, all of that to say is it has been hit uncharacteristically hard for Jeff Hoffman so far this year, giving up a 244 batting average against it, which isn't extreme, but that's the worst of any of Hoffman's pitches. And then there's a little bit, that's been the pitch, like he's had some like bad batted ball luck on a little bit too. But anyway, all of this is to say the slider to me has been the most reliable of those weapons. And I think he would prefer that to be, you know, his 2B pitch if everything's really rolling, because when the splitter's on is when he's most effective. Anyway, that's a rambly way to say, yeah, it's the fastball location, I think, is the primary thing. And that's kind of setting up, you know, sequencing issues or when you feel comfortable throwing the splitter or slider.
Yeah, it's a little, I think it's rambly because it's kind of frustrating that we are trying to figure out, why is this happening? Why does it keep happening?
Well, that's the thing, is the under the hood stuff isn't that alarming. Like, it's not, again, it's like Jordan Romano last year, it was really easy to point to the slider's not biting as much. The fastball velocity is down. You only throw two pitches. So if one of them's not there, you become pretty predictable. But Hoffman's got three pitches. The fastball and slider are in a better spot than Romano's were last year. I don't say this to pick on Romano. I just, because it's a conversation we also
had
last
before,
year.
For sure.
So from there, given how good Yariel Rodriguez has looked in leverage over the last couple months, Jimmy Garcia is expected to pitch in a minor league game today, but he's probably a couple rehab outings away. Does Yariel Rodriguez get the next save opportunity? John Schneider kind of poured water on that after the game, but how do you feel about that?
I've been saying that for like 3 weeks now, and I think, you know, it kind of comes and goes, of course, as Jeff Hoffman comes and goes as well a little bit, and his stuff comes and goes, but the truth of the matter is that the most reliable arm you have in that bullpen right now is Yariel Rodriguez. It just is. He's been extremely reliable for this team, very effective. He is throwing everything with confidence. The velocity is there. The slider's so good. When he throws that splitter, it's also like, oh, yeah, this is what it should kind of look like. And, you know, maybe more importantly, he has not let many situations snowball. You know, I even go back to the Cardinals series in which he allowed, I think it was a game tying home run at
and
that
then
point.
And came right back out the next inning.
And then came right back and threw a very good, very effective inning. So that's also a big component of it, is how do you bounce back from making a mistake and from allowing a base runner to reach or from allowing a run to score? These things matter. And Rodriguez, he just keeps delivering. So in a race as tight as the Blue Jays are right now, you kind of need to consider that. I understand that Hoffman was signed for this role, and maybe he still is the guy, right? We're not saying that this is going to last forever for the duration of his contract.
If Emmanuel Clase can get moved out of the closer role for 2 weeks while he, you know, figures it out, and you have a Cade Smith ready to go, I'm not saying Yariel Rodriguez is going to be Cade Smith forever, but he does have, what is it, 23 and two-thirds innings with only those two earned runs allowed from the St. Louis game.
That's ridiculously
good. Yeah, it's a 0.76 ERA over like almost 2 months now.
Yeah, he's found himself. He's found himself. He's found the rhythm that he needed. And more importantly, he was just built for those high-pressure situations. That is where he thrives. Everything about it, from body language to what he's throwing to his mentality to his relationship with the catchers in this team, everything is pointing to this is your best reliever right now. Why wouldn't you trust him with save situations while your closer is struggling? Again, Jeff Hoffman is not going to struggle forever, and he may still be a better option or a better bet to have this role in the midterm future, but it's not working right now, and the Blue Jays need to win games.
Yeah, and I think this is, were Jimmy Garcia healthy through all of this? I think this would have happened already.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Or some variation of that, right? Maybe Jimmy is not the ninth inning guy, but if you have an extra
reliable set in the order, then
it does open up some possibilities. But yeah, the Blue Jays are going to have to get creative here. And I understand John Schneider being in Hoffman's corner when he's asked about that, and no, he's our closer. Yes, that's great. Until you're in a situation like that and you need to make a decision, and we'll see what that decision is going to be. But yeah, in my mind, he's saying the right things. I'm still waiting to see how that is going to be managed when the time comes.
Yes, it's also part of this is also that Brendan Little has struggled a little bit, the last little bit too. Now, he has struggled with the command aspect. You know, that's never been his strong suit. He will walk guys.
Right.
But in particular, so he's got four walks over his last three outings, which two of them were shorter than an inning. So a bit of an alarm bell there, maybe a little bit of the league catching up to what he's done so well. He throws by far the fewest pitches in the zone of any pitcher in baseball. So if you are a team that does your advanced scout on him and that knuckle curve is so hard to hit and the sinker is so hard to hit anywhere other than on the ground, I think we're just starting to see teams kind of sit back and be like, if we're not going to be able to hit this anyway, why not make him throw a couple strikes first? Mm-hmm. And 33% of the pitches he throws are in the zone. That's by far the lowest in the league.
Yeah, and if you're a team that's preparing to face Brendan Little, you're right. You'll probably say, well, if I can't beat you, I'll just let you beat yourself here.
And it's like, it's a compliment because what are you going to do? You're not going to hit.
Right.
He has a 2.10 ERA even with a pretty high walk rate. Like, you just, so hard to get good contact against him that I think the book has to be, you just get really patient.
But I will say that that also explains the high pitch counts,
yes.
right? We've seen that so much from Brendan Little, and there's a reason why his outings have been shorter than an inning. It's that next thing you know, he's thrown 30 pitches and there's runners on first and second. And even when he's striking guys out, it's still taking him a painstaking amount of pitches and of effort to do so. So, yeah, listen, we knew this was going to happen. We knew the league was going to adjust to Brendan Little and he wasn't going to be that dominant for the rest of the year. The good news is that his profile last year was so different that maybe there's something there that he can draw from and find somewhat of a hybrid profile for the rest of the way here. Yes, the knuckle curve is nasty and it's going to get swing and miss, but it's okay to go back to the ground ball identity that, you know, got you here in the first place, got you with the Blue Jays in the first place. That might be perhaps a better way to move forward. Not easier said than done for sure, because like adjusting is never easy in this league. It's what I'm proposing is just some reason for optimism that Little was one guy last year. He was another guy to begin this season. Maybe he can combine both of them and sort of find a third identity.
Split the difference.
Yeah, why not?
Okay. Speaking of pitch efficiency, by the way, Laz Estrada, 19 pitch walk to Nick Sogard on the weekend. Unbelievable. I would be, if I was in a 19 pitch plate appearance, I would just like sit the bat down at some point. Like, I'm going home, throw a strike or throw a ball. I'm out of here. 19 pitch. We do have a couple small updates is why I bring that up.
Yep.
Ricky Tiedemann threw his first bullpen session last week, which is really fun and encouraging. Obviously that is a long road back from the UCL surgery, but threw his first bullpen last week, which is cool. Bowden Francis, in his injury recovery, not only received a cortisone shot, he also shaved his entire head.
Yes. Quite the reaction in the clubhouse.
Yes, I was talking to Tyler Heineman at that point, and like he comes out, and because I wasn't at the game Friday, yeah. I was like, I don't know if this is new or not. Like, maybe he shaved it yesterday, and I've already missed the reaction, but he like came into the clubhouse, and no one had seen it yet. Because the whole clubhouse was kind of looking over at it.
it was pretty funny.
Yeah.
No, you know, listen, first of all, it's nice to see Bowden sort of in good spirits. That kind of bodes well, for what the Blue Jays are trying to do with him and, you know, get him back on track, which has been kind of a process here. And what we keep hearing about this clubhouse is that they are there for each other in a way that is different and it's special. And those are the moments where we get to see it, where it's like, yeah, they're going to give this guy a hard time for shaving his head. And then it's like, well, you should have kept the beard. You should have kept the mustache. You know, it's...
I disagree on the mustache. The bicked head with a mustache still is not a... I don't know. I'm not a mustache guy, so maybe I'm the wrong person to ask. But,
yeah, that's fair.
The other big update... Max Scherzer will pitch on Wednesday against the Cleveland Guardians. Mm-hmm. He's ready to go 80 to 85 pitches. It sounds like the context, there was a little more soreness than maybe they anticipated coming out of his last rehab start. But he threw a bullpen yesterday, a shorter one, and he is going to start Wednesday. Eric Lauer will start Tuesday. Ideally, they would have split those guys up. But they're talking about Eric Lauer as if he's not an 80 to 85 pitch guy. He is just a starter. They have, I believe John Schneider used the term, he has deserves more leash at this point. And then, yeah, if Scherzer is at 80 to 85 pitches, you know, those guys probably aren't going seven innings, but at least the hope can be that they give you five. That will move Spencer Turnbull into a TBD bullpen role. Yep. They have said, they have expressed the desire to keep him stretched out where possible, but if the starters pitch well, Turnbull's not going to have an opportunity to go, you know, 50 plus pitches. So we'll see how that gets managed. I imagine Paxton Schultz will be the corresponding move Wednesday, but it could depend how the bullpen gets used on Tuesday as well.
Yeah, that's good news. I mean, you don't really know exactly what you're going to get from Max Scherzer. You don't really know how the thumb is going to react to just being back in major league action, but the prospect of having a 5-man rotation and, you know, not having to count on bullpen days and piecing stuff together to get you through a stretch, that in itself is just, it's such a positive for the Blue Jays. I cannot believe that we updated people on Bowden Francis' haircut before we talked about Max Scherzer coming back to the rotation.
Well, it's a build. There is a cadence and a momentum I'm trying to do. It's rule of threes. Also, I had three updates. So I went from the lowest one to the biggest one.
Wow. Everything is thought out in this show.
Yes.
Is where we're getting.
Except for the next segment. We have done no work for that. So we're going to rely on you guys. We're going to do a mailbag segment after the break here. Text us at 590-590. Standard message and data rates may apply. Any questions you got? What's on your mind about the Toronto Blue Jays? We have some leftover ones from last week as well. Most of them are about the starting rotation and everyone getting an early start on trade season, which is always fun. Text us 590-590. We'll answer your text on the other side. In the second hour, we'll talk to Jeremy Machino of Pitch Profiler. We'll get into some of the underlying stuff with Jeff Hoffman, with Brandon Little, with Kevin Gausman. We'll also talk to Jake Mintz of Cespedes Family Barbecue. NCAA tournament ended in ump show fashion yesterday, complete with a WWE-level ref tripping on himself and flailing around and then trying to blame the coach for it. We'll also go around what happened in Major League Baseball, including the Tampa Bay Rays just won't go away. It's annoying. Anyway, all of that is next. Your text to us as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you.
Blake's scared to sneeze away. Sneezed once and I was waiting for the other one.
That's weird. Then, Why would you do that?
I don't know. He just made a funny comment and instead of sneezing, I started laughing and here we are.
That's it. They say to look at the lights when you don't want to sneeze, which doesn't work for me. Obviously, I have to mute my mic to sneeze once or twice a show. But that's the real answer.
Listen, you look up here with the amount of times that you sneeze, that's just not, I have to imagine, it's just not true because this room is the most well-lit room I have ever seen. And you still sneeze an average of 5 times a show.
Yeah, I sneeze a lot. I don't know what to do about that. I don't know what it says about me. Anyway,
we forgive you.
This segment is all you guys. We got text in the text line. You can text us the 590-590 standard message and data rates may apply, which you should know by now, but I have to say it every single time so you don't sue us for your 50 cents back. Okay, what do we got in there?
All right, I should start wearing my glasses for these segments, but that's a note for next time.
Do you want mine?
Yeah, sure. That's how it works. All right. So let's start with new ones. We have some older ones as well. But there are a couple of very good ones that are timely, I guess, with the conversations that we are having after the weekend. Tyler in London, for example, asking if it's possible to get a back-end rental arm like a David Bednar or maybe an Aroldis Chapman on the market. He says these wins could matter in a big way later on. I will agree with that part. Tell me your thoughts on getting another reliever.
Yeah, I think they'll absolutely be in the market for at least one, probably two. I've been trying to trade David Bednar to the Blue Jays for like 3 seasons now because he makes more money than like a mediocre closer should. And Pittsburgh's a small market, small budget team. So I would imagine they would be financially motivated. He's not having the best season, but I do think he's like 10 for 11 in save opportunities. He was down in AAA at one point. I think that's one where like he's not gonna take over for Jeff Hoffman. He's not gonna slot in ahead of Jimmy Garcia, but you could probably get him for not a ton more than just taking on the money from Pittsburgh at the deadline. Chapman, I am less interested in. I know the numbers are really good. There's the off-field stuff.
This market is not really conducive.
Yeah, and it's a red flag when like you keep bouncing around everywhere and no one wants 100%. To keep you. And I know the stuff is there, but you can do differently. The Marlins have a few interesting names. I don't know. There will be teams that fall out of it. And Kyle Finnegan from the Nationals would be interesting as the Nationals continue their free fall.
That would be interesting.
So we'll get into specifics between now and July 31st, obviously. But yes, Tyler, the answer is not only is it possible to get a back-end rental arm, I would be very surprised if the Blue Jays are not looking at someone that would slot into the seventh inning or higher.
It's funny because you look at the list of priorities. There is quite a bit on the shopping list for the Blue Jays. I'm wondering if it just so happens that they can't make any significant additions to this bullpen, but Jimmy Garcia comes back and is healthy. Brendan Little figures out some things here and there. What do you think? Would that be a complete failure, or can they get by for the entire season with the guys that they have right now?
No, I don't think so. I think it's also like it's the easiest spot to address. Like the Blue Jays have bigger needs than just
the bullpen, but you can't assume Jeff Hoffman will figure it out, even if we're like the under the hood stuff suggests he probably will. You can't assume Jeff Hoffman and Yara Rodriguez and Brandon Little and Jimmy Garcia will all be healthy.
Yeah.
You can't really assume Nick Sandlin and Ryan Burr are going to, like, you can assume each of those things individually. I don't think you can assume all of those things are going to work out at the same time. I think, you know, if you were heading into the playoffs with Mason Fluharty and Chad Green on your bullpen depth chart as anything other than like the bottom guys, I think I would be uncomfortable with that. So yeah, some of these guys are going to say Braden Fisher's been really nice, but it's not that asset cost heavy to go out and get one more guy. And look, if you got to say Braden Fisher, you've been really great. We appreciate you're a part of the future, but you have options. So for a couple weeks here, it's not the end of the world if you got to do that, because I don't think, even if you look at what they have right now, you add Ryan Burr and Jimmy Garcia back to that, I don't think you can mix and match your way there. I think you need one more at least.
Yeah, there's a couple of missing pieces there for sure. And you are right that this is probably going to be the easiest addition for the Blue Jays to make when it comes to, you know, finding a trade partner and giving up not a ton of prospect capital and things along those lines.
And it might not, this is so weird to say, it might not even be as sexy as like David Bednar or Kyle Finn. Like, you might get Anthony Bender. Right, I don't know. But there are going to be guys.
Agreed. That's going to be a fascinating conversation because, the Blue Jays have a lot to look for on the market. Okay, Howie in Thornhill. This is amazing. Do you think the Sunday game was the worst of the season in the way the Blue Jays lost? I have an opinion, but I want to hear yours first.
It's like, it's not so much the way in which it happened, but like the quality of competition. I don't know, like getting walked off by the Red Sox really sucked. Mm-hmm. I know that was a long time ago now, and the Red Sox don't look that good. Also, In the moment, I thought the walk-off against the Angels was the worst one.
Yes.
Because we didn't think, like, the Angels have proven since then they're actually not that bad. They're not as bad as the White Sox. I still think, based on how that one felt, it was also like a late-night West Coast weeknight game. So we're all up at, like, 1 in the morning watching the end of that one. I'm going to say that one still felt worse. Yeah. This one, obviously, the error sucks. But getting walked off is always going to be tougher, I think, than like you blew it in the eighth.
Yeah.
Do you disagree?
No, I think that's fair. To me, opening day was still the worst loss of the season because it was just so explosive the way that it happened.
Yeah, I remember kicking it around that day. So we didn't have a show. We did a show opening day, but we weren't doing shows regularly. And I forget which other team, but some team in baseball got walked off that day and blew a lead. And I remember talking to friends about like, you know what it was? Devin Williams, the Yankees were up 3 and he almost blew the save. And we were kicking around, what's a worse opening day loss? Is getting absolutely blown out out of the gates, or you blow a good game where the closer you just picked up blows the save. Devin Williams ended up hanging on in that one, though, so it ended up being moot. But in the moment, we were discussing that.
Yeah, that's a good discussion. It's just that, you know, it was the first opening day at home in, like, 3 years or whatever it was.
Yeah, no, that sucked. 12-2?
Yeah, and it was, like, 7 homers or something like that the Orioles hit. And then just...
And they haven't hit one since.
Exactly. And then just the fact that the Orioles did not go on to do any of the things that we expected them to do. I think that one still ranks number one for me. It was it was weird.
All right, what else we got?
We got Frank in Toronto here saying, I think Eric Lauer should be given the 5th starting spot until further notice. Well,
I mean, he has
good news. Yeah, good news, buddy.
Yeah, that's the case. Yeah. Eric Lauer is the 5th starter. We'll see. Bowden Francis is going to be at least a couple weeks away. He got a cortisone shot, so he's not throwing right now. Spencer Turnbull, I do not think, has made a case for being a part of that conversation, and he's not optionable, so you have to keep him stretched out in a relief role anyway. Adam Macko made another start at AAA on the weekend. He's fine, but I think, like, even best case scenario, he's the, we need an emergency starter. There's a doubleheader today. Someone is banged up or whatever. That's what he's trying to work his way back to. I think it's Eric Lauer's spot until it's not.
Yeah. And he's definitely earned it. He's a guy who's been around. He's done so much. And I don't know. It feels to me a little bit like when you experience some success in this league, but then that doesn't really sustain, you have to go somewhere else, like Korea, to sort of rediscover yourself and try to keep your career going. And then you get a chance to come back. Like, there's just so much going on there that, when John Schneider says he knows how to pitch, it's because, listen, he's been doing it for a while now, and he's been doing it in so many different stages. And at this
and
point,
countries.
Exactly. And at this point, he knows who he is, and he knows what he has to offer. Very, very smart guy to talk to as well. So, yeah. Now, we should be pretty happy, all things considered.
Yeah. Now, having said that, there are about 50 questions in the text line from last week as well about trading for a fourth or fifth starter. And similar to what I just said about all the ifs, all the assumptions you have to make about the bullpen to be confident about it, assuming full health for starting rotation, Bowden Francis comes back healthy, Alec Manoah late in the season, Eric Lauer and Max Scherzer are both good and things like that. That's a lot of assumptions where I think you would rather, if the trade deadline were today, even though Eric Lauer's been nice and Max Scherzer's back, you're still looking to fortify that. And whether it means, hey, we have the opportunity to go to a six-man in September and keep everyone fresh, or Eric Lauer's back to a bulk role or whatever, I don't think this means he is locked in between now and the end of September and you're not looking at that. But for, yeah, in right now, he's the fifth starter until he's not,
yeah,
to me.
Yeah. All right, more trade questions. Jay Contrano. All the Jays bench guys are lefty outfielders. Do you trust David Schneider to pinch hit lefties in field, or do we need a right-handed bench infielder?
Well, you know who doesn't trust David Schneider to do that?
Tell me.
John Schneider. yesterday, in the eighth inning of a two-run game, Andrés Giménez, who is, look, the defense is nice. I think we agree that the path to him being an average hitter is there.
It's
you
there.
Can see it under the hood and things like that.
But
he is in the mud right now. And lefty on lefty in a close game, down two.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the defensive component is there, but you're behind. You need to score runs. And David Schneider is sitting there on the bench and doesn't get used in that spot. There have been times where Miles Straw and Jonathan Classe hit above him as bench bats. If you look at the numbers, and David Schneider had a nice start on the weekend, he has a 358 OBP. I know the batting average isn't very good. He hasn't hit for power or whatever. At least he's getting on base when he gets those opportunities. No, it's not like an unbelievable profile. I think he should be getting more opportunities than he is if he's going to be on the roster. But John Schneider clearly disagrees. So I would say for the purposes of you got to get a guy they'll actually use, like Andrés Giménez lefty on lefty trailing in the eighth inning is an absolute must pinch hit spot for me until the bat comes around. And even then, he's probably going to be a platoon split guy. If you're not going to use your righty bench bat in that situation, you have to get someone that you will use in that situation. Now, I don't know, you know, positionally, I don't think it'll matter all that much. But if you're not going to use David Schneider as a pinch hitter in that spot, get someone in there who you will use. And and that's not a negative about David Schneider from my perspective. But
all.
If John Schneider is not going to use him in that spot, you got to get someone you can use, because that spot is going to come up in meaningful games again.
Yeah, that's a good point. And listen, Davis Schneider has shown a ton of improvements since he came back. We also need to consider that the batting average, the way that it is, that's also a product of being really bad earlier in the year before he was optioned.
You know what makes it difficult to get your batting average back up?
Not getting
plate appearances.
100%.
Yeah.
And when he's playing well. And, you know, he holds his own in the outfield.
Like what? He went 2-for-3 on Saturday.
That's right, with an extra base hit. So.
And hadn't played for a couple days before that. I know he was hitless in his last couple before that, but he's still drawing some walks here and there. Look, I'm not saying David Schneider is going to, if you start playing him every day and pinching him every time, he's going to be Fenway debut David Schneider. But if you're going to have a righty who is there to hit lefties off the bench and you don't use him to hit lefties in big righty versus lefty spots, then yeah, you got to, speaking of righties who hit lefties well, can you give me the two Ernie questions, please?
Oh my God. That was
where you were going?
Segue. Okay. Oh, I love that. We're syncing up. Okay. Paul and Colonna, this is not much mention about Clement these days. Hits, runs scored, solid defense. He is our unsung hero. I feel like we have talked about
Yeah.
Him.
Look, what was the chirp you had? Show starts at 10, Paul. Lock in the whole time. Look, so this question came in, I think, last Friday.
Yeah.
We had talked about Ernie Clement earlier in that show. We did a whole segment last week on how effective he's been hitting against lefties and doing early count fastballs. Mm-hmm. I even did a Blue Jay Central thing on it. The last time we did a mailbag, I think it was Michelle had me look at everyone who is potentially eligible for the utility.
That's right.
Gold Glove, who's bounced around. We talked about that. Yes, Ernie Clement's been awesome. Mm-hmm. He's hitting over 300. He's been worth 2.4 wins above replacement, estimated so far by Fangraphs. So he's been awesome, but we have been talking about it. And then when you do talk about it enough, you get questions like this one.
Chris in Regina. Given the Jays have a lot of infielders and how well Clement is playing, would trading Clement at his peak value get you a masher or a pitcher? What is your thought on that?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think, like, you immediately have an, or this is, it's the same thing I feel when people throw Bo Bichette into trades. It's like, I get it, like, value wise, but then you have a Bo Bichette sized hole you also have to fill in a trade. Look, Addison Barger has been awesome. They want the flexibility of being able to use him in right field a little bit as necessary. You want to be able to mix and match. And I'm not saying like they are full-time platoon guys, but there might be a lefty that you face in the playoffs that you don't want Addison Barger starting against. And you don't want to have to be locked into that. And it's also possible, like, as the season goes, Addison Barger might cool off and then heat back up or whatever. You need... The issue is rarely that you have too many good players. And I think between Jimenez... and Clement and Barger's ability to play right field, there are going to be enough opportunities for all of those guys. Now, look, if you go and try to get a star, if Chris Sale is available and Alex Anthopoulos says, I am not doing that without Ernie Clement in the deal, you start to explore it.
Yeah.
But right now, I'm not looking at the way the Jays are currently constructed and saying they have too many good players and you need to trade from that. I think there's going to be plenty of opportunity for Ernie Clement, Andrés Giménez, and Addison Barger. There's lots of opportunities.
Yeah. And by the way, I don't think Chris Sale is going to be available.
No, but he's not. But that's why I used him as an example.
The extreme case of there's this superstar that is available, and then sure, you entertain that.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Anyway, those two texters to talk. The guy who thinks we don't pump Ernie Clement up enough and the guy who wants to trade him. You guys go meet up and chat it out. Let us know where you land between the two of you.
All right, let's do a couple more here. We have time for that. Brad and Ennismore, I want to say. 4 games back of the Yankees.
Yes, it's pronounced Brad.
Every single time. I think we went through this last week as well. It is a good bit. 4 games back of the Yankees for the AL East crown. Confidence level that the Blue Jays can take the division. Where is your confidence? Right
yeah,
now?
I mean, not high. It's not necessarily a confidence thing, but 4 games is a lot to make up. Mm-hmm. The other context there is that the Rays are in the way. Yep. So you not only have to catch up 4 on the Yankees, you have to fend off the Rays and catch up a game and a half on them. This is a really interesting question next week when they play 4 against the Yankees at Rogers Center. You take 3 out of 4. Like if you hold serve this week and you take 3 out of 4 against the Yankees, you start to feel really, really good. That lead was down as small as 2 last week. So I don't know. I would say it's like the odds are probably worse than a third at this point, but they're certainly higher than 0. So that's nice. Like, I don't know. I'll put it maybe 15%. Fangraphs has it at 8%. I think it's higher than that.
Yeah, I don't know. If you win this series against the White Sox like you were supposed to, maybe the confidence level is a little bit higher. But when you have those chances to beat bad teams and make up some ground and all of that, and the Yankees are winning again, and they're probably not going to have a skid as bad as what they did earlier this month again.
And
right?
all the areas you're going to be shopping in at the trade deadline, the Yankees will also be shopping in.
Yeah.
So that always complicates things too.
It does.
Here's a question from Mike in Cambridge.
I
will always get a Cambridge question in. So Mike asks, where did you get that great Montreal 1976 shirt?
Olympic Stadium.
Okay.
Yeah. Just go to Montreal. It's actually pretty cool to hang out in that area. They also have I think it's FC Montreal now, the name of the soccer team there. It used to be the Montreal Impact. Anyway, they have that stadium there. There's a nice park. I love Montreal. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this isn't my first Olympic Stadium t-shirt. Probably won't be the last.
Okay.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah. Montreal is great. Because the Jays did not make the playoffs last year, I got to go to Montreal for Raptors training camp. Hopefully that isn't the case this year. Those things overlap. I would rather be covering a wild card series, but
yeah. In training camp?
Yeah. Although, and I don't even, it probably won't be in Montreal the second year in a row.
Well, I think that's it. I think we did good work here. We still have a ton of texts left, and we'll kind of comb through them. And
a lot of them
relevant.
Are like apologies to the people who we didn't get to, but a lot of the like trade stuff is like, we are going to talk about it over the course of the next month. You don't have to worry that we're not going to talk about going after an ace pitcher or a bullpen or whatever it is. So we always do save these. And as long as they're not time sensitive, we will keep them and try to get to them. But the trade stuff, That's all July, baby.
We got it's you. Like, don't worry. Yeah. We see you, and we'll talk about it. And thank you for
sending
Nicholson
in the Smith and I already got. We got to start building the spreadsheet. I think there was one year that like I pulled for relief options. I pulled all the good relievers with like a certain strikeout, walk, home run level. So like these are my minimum requirements. And then I filtered out all the ones that were on good teams who wouldn't trade them away. And there was still a list of like 42 relievers that you could conceivably trade for or something like
that. How long did that take you?
Not that long.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Impressive 15 minutes stuff. Maybe?
Wow. Just pull the, yeah, I don't know.
Okay. Well, you know, Blake is kind of a numbers
whiz. Scrape the data,
whiz,
put a couple filters in there and... Yeah, speaking of self-teaching yourself computer skills from baseball. So how I got very good at Excel, and obviously Excel is outdated now, and I have taught myself Python, but I'm still way behind everyone because everyone can do like machine learning stuff now. 15 years ago, being really good at Excel was very valuable, and I taught myself how to do all that using baseball and football stuff. I was like, what if I make my own fantasy baseball model, and this is how I teach myself how to do all the crazy stuff in Excel and things like that. That is how our next guest not taught himself because he was a software engineer, but this is how he honed his skills. We're going to talk to Pitch Profiler next. So another one of these kind of pitch design metrics. So Jeremy Machino is the person behind that. He was a college pitcher himself and then decided to do that. And that's how he kind of fine-tuned his software engineering skills. We'll take a break. We'll talk to him about that story. We'll also talk to him about a couple of these Blue Jays that have yellow flags in the profile. We're also getting a Chase Burns Major League Baseball debut tomorrow for the Cincinnati Reds. We'll talk about that as well. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. No giggling as we come back on. We were appropriate during the break this time.
Zero.
Nothing.
Zero fun.
No nonsense. 0 days since last nonsense. Well, zero segments. Anyway, no nonsense in this next one. Let's get to it. We're joined now by Jeremy Machino. He's Pitch Profiler on social media. Jeremy, good morning. How are you doing?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. Man, I have about a million questions about how Pitch Profiler got its start and your path and things like that. I know you've written about it a little bit in the past, but for our audience who's not familiar, take me through a little bit, college pitcher to Pitch Profiler. What got you started kind of modeling pitches?
Yep. So I started out on Pitch Profiler in about 2019. Funny enough, it was a kind of a project to show that I could actually do work in a corporate setting. Just kind of an example of, you know, everything I did in college. I went to college as a software engineer and I wasn't getting much traction. So I was like, hey, I'm just going to show people that I can do this. And then, you know, it kind of just took off. I started doing like, you know, images I post on Twitter. I posted under myself before I was a Pitch Profiler. It's more of like a Twins fan, kind of just doing Twin stuff. 2021 rolled around. I met a guy named Robbie Rowland. He introduced me to some of his friends who played big league baseball, and they started to like hit me up. Hey, can I have your like reports, your summaries, your stuff like that? And at the time, I was like printing them through my computer, and I'm like, this is just not, you know, not a fun time for me. So I ended up actually making the website. That was about 2020, and then 2021 we started to implement the modeling. So Pitch Profiler's version of Stuff Plus, Pitching Plus, Location Plus, and then XWIF Plus was like a little fun side stat. The first iteration of Stuff Plus was, you know, very simple. Just looked at velocity and the movement profiles. And man, as as we've gotten to know pitching, I saw you had Mike Petriello on a little earlier. Him and his team have put out a lot of really cool things. So it's gone from just looking at like movement profiles to like arm angle, acceleration. So basically scaling movement for velocity, how a pitch interacts with its fastball, and just like release point as well. So it's gone from like a 5-input model to, I think I'm currently working on the next iteration and it's got like 20 inputs. So it just continues to grow. I probably got to pare it down once I figure out, you know, how everything works around it. But it's gone from small to large real quick.
Nice.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's such an interesting thing. So like when I've played around, I do not know how to do like much machine learning stuff or whatever, but playing around with it, like one of the, so like last year I tried to do my own fantasy baseball projection model, and like one of, and it's like, oh, we have all these new inputs now. It's like trying to figure out what actually is important, or what, like, you know, you take out some of the interrelationship stuff so that, I don't know, the significance testing or whatever, so you can kind of pare it down. Before we get into some of that stuff, though, I'm very, very curious. So you mentioned Robbie Rowland, who I know you've done some YouTube stuff with as well. So was he like asking you like, hey man, can you give me stuff on like my Puerto Rican Winter League stuff as well? Or is the data there like too limited for you to have been helping him out in like the Indies and PR Winter League?
So he gave me like his data.
Okay.
From like Rapsodo and any like sort of TrackMan or Yakker Tech he had. And we kind of like tried to like pair it together.
Okay.
So it was more of like an estimation for his point. Unfortunately, he's now no longer playing in the Winter League because we do get StatCast for some Winter League games. So I've been like looking like through Winter League games on a couple guys. I'm like, wow, these guys used to play pro ball, probably still could.
Jeremy, you mentioned, you know, other models and even a guy like Petriello and the work that he does and his team does. There's a lot of information out there. There are a lot of different models. And I'm just wondering, you know, when you're figuring out your methodology here, what is it that sticks out to you? What did you want to make really unique about Pitch Profiler?
Yep. So the real big one was when they brought out arm angle. I noticed there were pitchers with like higher arm slots that were not playing as well as, or they were playing much better in my stuff model than they were in actuality. And it's because of basically the way how you throw a ball. We have like our pronators and our supinators. So pronators are going to get behind the ball more. And those balls are going to move in the way that their arm slot is. So if you have a high arm slot guy, that ball is going to move straight and it's not going to drop a lot.
But Lucas Giolito as an example.
Yes, exactly. So it'll move. And those are like the movement profiles you expect as a hitter. And then on the flip side, you have a supinator who generally will like release the ball with a little bit of cut and it'll spin more. And those kind of guys can create some like insane movement profiles. So like Clay Holmes does it really well. I know you can look at the Mariners starting rotation. They love their supinators. Like people like that, people with really big sweepers, I should say too. Those are your big supinator guys. They throw really hard breaking balls, throw bowling ball sinkers, or I mean, the Cubs love their supinators too. They love their high slot supinators though, or high ride supinators. So like Drew Pomeranz, he kind of came back into the picture this year. I haven't checked recently, but he hadn't like allowed a run in probably like a month. And he's just got this insane four-seam fastball that moves like no one would expect.
He's a fun example. Mm. He still hasn't allowed a run in forever. So that's it's nice. I believe his ERA is still zero.
That's absurd.
Yes, good for Drew Pomeranz. It's a funny one where like the X ERA is 4.40. So like obviously we're not capturing everything in expected ERA. So I wasn't going to go there quite yet, but because we're talking about arm slots and supination, what do you make of Brendan Little? Because he's got obviously that deadly knuckle curve that no one can hit. The command isn't always great, but you talk about bowling ball sinkers. You talk about supinating from a low arm slot. What have you made of Brendan Little's kind of breakout season here?
So Brendan Little's a really cool example of the low slot supinator. He doesn't have the cut ride fastball that most low slot supinators have. But he has that, like you said, the bowling ball sinker. And then what I really like is his knuckle curve as well. The really cool thing about his knuckle curve is when you adjust for his arm angle, it's more like a screwball. And it moves less glove side than what you would expect. And it drops more than you expect. So like hitters are just completely confused by this knuckle curve. And then he comes and throws the sinker that just drops off the table. And I mean, you see it in the whiff rates, like sinkers are not high whiff rate pitches, and he's getting insane whiff rates for a sinker. And then when you pair that with that that knuckle curve, I think when I last checked, it was over like a 50% whiff rate.
Oh, yeah. 57.
Yeah, it's those are just an insane pairing that you don't see every day. And it's because that low slot supination, or I should say just that supination in general, combined with the low slot, that makes him so tough to figure out.
So the other thing that's popped up a little with Brendan Little of late is Alex Chamberlain of Fangraphs did some work on some of this new bat tracking data that we have to try to create a kind of implied miss amount. Like how badly are you swinging and missing? And Brendan Little's knuckle curve was the top pitch in baseball. So this question is not necessarily about Little, but have you gotten to a point with all of this new bat tracking and attack angle and things like that where that is starting to play into your pitch profiler model, or is it still a little too early with that data to kind of fully integrate it?
So it's a little early, but I do have a couple ideas that I'd like to like look at. And the first one is like approach angle matching. So we have bat approach angle and vertical approach angle. And we know like Ted Williams has talked about this way back in the 40s. If you can match the plane of the ball with your bat, you're going to be really good. And so trying to figure out pitches like Brendan Little's knuckle curve that will make it almost impossible to match that plane, where hitters literally have to swing basically a sand wedge to hit the ball. Yeah, like those pitches are, we can even just use our eyes and say like, hey, like this hitter cannot match the plane of the ball because of just how it moves. So that is like something I would like to explore. We only have, I think, probably like a year and a half worth of data. I know for swing path and swing speed, I don't know about approach angle, but I think once we get more data, that's definitely something that I would like to incorporate into my models.
You know, Jeremy, Brendan Little was kind of a surprise, right, season. I mean, no one expected him to get the amount of swing and miss that he is, and it's been obviously a pleasant surprise for the Blue Jays. We're starting to see maybe the league adjust, and, you know, we'll see how he sort of responds to that. But as you're putting together something as detailed as Pitch Profiler, in which you're looking at so many different aspects of a pitcher and what he can do, I'm wondering how often you come across these surprises and, you know, I guess how accurately you're able to predict, okay, this guy is going to have a breakout, or we should keep an eye on this name. What is that process like for you?
Yeah, it goes a little deeper than stuff, especially for like relievers. You always get these guys that come out with like the nastiest breaking balls, throw hard, right? And then you see their stuff is like, I'll give an example, like a 150 stuff plus guy in spring training. But then you kind of got to look deeper, right? Like stuff only captures how nasty a pitcher is. You still have to figure out, hey, is this guy going to walk 14 guys per nine? So that whole process, like I'll start in spring training, start like paring down guys. And like, I guess a good example would be like Louis Varland or in 2024, or 2023, Emilio Pagan. Emilio had a terrible season for the Twins in 22. And I was like, guys, just hold your horses. Home run luck is just random. He's got good stuff. Hasn't really been a bad walk rate guy. So I was like, hey guys, let's calm the brakes, hold it a little bit. And it ended up, he had a great season 2023, went out and got himself a good contract in 24. And now he's one of the NL leaders in saves in 25. And his stuff is nastier than ever. And he's, he's still got the slight walk issues, but when you get a guy with like Emilio Pagan who has like the 20-inch induced vertical break from an average arm slot, hitters have such a tough time picking that up. It just doesn't drop like they think. And then he throws it so much, and he has that cutter that, you know, he can play off with the four seam, but he's just got that one pitch that is just hard for hitters to pick up on. So it's a combination of stuff. I look at strikeout minus walk rate a lot too, FIP, and then XERA. And then kind of like chase rate is a good one too. If you can get to it, out of zone chase rate kind of shows how nasty a pitcher can be if you don't have the stuff numbers as well.
Yeah, that's fascinating. The Pagan example is an interesting one where like, I end up thinking of like, okay, which organizations do we think of as smart and what are they doing? So like the fact that Mason Montgomery had like, was running like a high five ZRA for a long time and the Rays didn't send him down. It's like, well, the Rays know. They're a smart org, and now he's well, still ERA is a little high, but still the stuff has come around. The walk rates come around and things like that. Okay, I wanted to ask you about a couple names specifically, and I gave you the heads up, so I'm not putting you on the spot here. We were talking off the top here about Jeff Hoffman's season so far. So he blew his fourth save yesterday. It was mostly based on an error that he himself committed, but it hasn't been the sharpest of seasons for him. Something like expected ERA says he's been okay. The strikeout rate is still really, really good. What have you seen under the hood with Jeff Hoffman?
Yeah, I was looking into him. I think he's got the home run bug problem that we kind of like alluded to with Emilio Pagan. I don't really think there's much wrong with Hoffman other than he's just getting barreled right now. Nothing says that he's really any different than years prior. Stuff is still nasty. He's still, you know, the same Jeff Hoffman in terms of striking guys out. He's not walking many people. I think it's literally just bad luck right now. And it's tough to say that because, right, he blew the save yesterday. He's had a tough couple months, but, right, he still throws hard. he's still, I mean, like, even when he was with the Twins, he only got the spring training shot, and I was so hoping they would take a chance on him. And he went to the Phillies. Phillies picked him up, and he's still like his movement profiles are still the same as he is with the Phillies. I think it's just bad luck, and I do think he will be able to turn around.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. It's also good to hear. I've said this to Blake before. Baseball people don't really do well with not being able to explain something and just, you know, accepting that some things are random and some things are just bad luck. And seeing Jeff Hoffman kind of go through that. But then if you dig a little deeper and that's still the case, then great. There's reason to be confident there. And another guy that's been kind of up and down for the Blue Jays this season, and at times it's seemed like a bit of bad luck, and at times it seemed like, okay, the stuff is just not moving the way that it's supposed to, is Kevin Gausman, right? Who had a great fastball to start the season, couldn't get anything done with the splitter. Now it seems to be a little bit in reverse. How do you evaluate an up and down season for Gausman up to this point?
Yeah, Gausman's a little different. His like he throws the splitter, right? And his splitter is incredibly volatile, kind of like most splitters. So it's really hard to command. You see it with like Yamamoto and Roki Sasaki. Their splitters, they sometimes run into issues with command. And, you know, over time you can fix that. His fastball is still pretty similar to it when it was in 2023 when he was great. I think his like big unlock will be finding that that slider, so he becomes a more of a three-pitch pitcher instead of a two-pitch pitcher, because right now he's like 90-something percent fastball splitter. And I looked at his movement profiles. It looked like he looks like he's played around with two different sliders. And I think, you know, you just need time to figure out what's going to work, what doesn't work. And a lot of the time we see pitchers, you know, go over All-Star break, and they come out and they work on a pitch over the All-Star break. So I'm really hoping Gausman can figure out that slider over the All-Star break, because I think once he gets that third pitch down and confident with that third pitch, I think he'll, you know, start to revert back to that 2023 self. And I looked in 2023, he also like experimented with the sweeper. Really good, only threw like 1% of the time. If he could get that, I think, you know, sky's the limit for Gausman.
Yeah, toy with the two-seamer here and there as well in the past. Okay, I want to go outside of Toronto because it's a fun pitching matchup week already. We're going to get Jacob Mizorowski against Paul Skeens on Wednesday, which is really fun. And Paul Skeens, oh, number one pick. He got to the majors so quick. Well, guess who's debuting tomorrow? Chase Burns is expected to be called up for the Cincinnati Reds, according to a report from our pal C. Trent Rosencrantz. He was the number two pick last year. He has pitched a whopping 66 minor league innings with a 37% strikeout rate and a 5% walk rate. You want to talk about using strikeout minus walk rate as an indicator? This is really fast, obviously, but what are you looking forward to with the Chase Burns debut potentially tomorrow? And yeah, I mean, what's under the hood with him other than, my God, this guy's so nasty so quick?
Chase Burns will be a fun one to watch. Like, we got to watch him a little bit in spring training with the Reds when they pulled him up and let him throw a couple like late innings, and he was, you know, just torching batters. And it was once you saw that, you're like, this guy is not going to be in the minors for long. And he's got the I would say more of like a cut ride fastball from his arm slot. It doesn't, you know, drop more than expected, or it doesn't rise more than expected. It does have a little more glove side movement than expected, though, for his fastball. And he can get it up to like 100 miles per hour. And then he's got that traditional slider to go with it. And then he's working on a changeup, I should say. But, you know, when you throw 100 miles per hour and you don't walk a lot of guys, you're in pretty good position. And, like, we've seen that throughout the minors. He rose is just as fast as Paul Skeens. He hasn't really ran into issues yet. And, you know, it'll be a really fun matchup to see him go against, I believe it's the Yankees tomorrow he plays. So he's getting thrown right into the fire. And we'll see how he does, but I'm really looking forward to it. I think he is going to, you know, kind of take MLB by storm, kind of like the other guys we've alluded to with Skeens and Mizorowski, who Skeens matches up with later.
Yeah, we got to see Chase Burns in a high profile NCAA slot for Wake Forest last year. I believe a pretty big game against Trey Savage at one point. I don't know, maybe Trey Savage won that battle. I don't know. Another fun college pitcher to dive into is yourself, Jeremy, at Upper Iowa back in 2018, 2019. Before we let you go, you obviously can't go back and model your own stuff. I don't know if you had data on it. How would your stuff look under Pitch Profiler's lens?
So I topped out at 87 miles per hour at D2. My stuff plus would look worse than probably every guy you've seen in my in my models. The hardest I ever threw a baseball was 89 miles per hour. And, you know, we have like the fun little gadgets, like I'll shout out Pitch Logic. They have a cheap little ball that, you know, displays your metrics. And I would play around with that. I was basically your stock pronator. I didn't, you know, wasn't able to throw anything special. Wasn't able to, you know, get a high ride fastball out of it. So I like basically I'll throw your stock changeup, stock slider, stock curveball, stock four seam, and, you know, go to men's league and have fun in men's league after college. But there was, you know, not good enough stuff to, you know, consider indie ball or any sort of like pro entry level stuff.
Yeah, it's still fun though. You hit 89. That's harder than I've hit and harder than I can hit off of. So,
and you're still relevant. You're still in the industry 100%, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, it's great. Jeremy, this has been a lot of fun, man. Great to get to chat with you. And thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for having me on. I had a blast. And I just, you know, if you want to check out the website, it's MLBPitchProfiler.com, or you can just find me on social media. It's Pitch Profiler.
Yeah, awesome. We'll do that. A lot of good stuff there.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Jeremy.
Absolutely. See you later.
Jeremy Machino, Pitch Profiler. Again, you can follow it at Pitch Profiler anywhere on social media, MLBPitchProfiler.com. It's funny. It reminds me a little bit like where he is. You know, he pitched and will do some men's league stuff and has this side of it. Blue Jays assistant pitching coach Sam Green, who was pitching for the Toronto Maple Leafs of the Inter-County Baseball League as recently as last year.
Right.
I don't think he was doing anything public-facing like Pitch Profiler, but going down there, getting your log in your innings.
Absolutely.
So that, you know, I don't know, Max Scherzer has someone to toss with.
Yeah, and talk about turning a hobby into a career, which I know you know a lot about as well. This man cannot have a hobby without turning it into a career of some sort.
Yeah.
And I forgot to mention this at the beginning of the show, but talking to your mom was also very clarifying in the sense that she just gave me all of the deets and all of the stories of you being a numbers nerd as a little kid and using it for sports and finding a way to connect the two. Now here you are 45 years later.
45. Get out of here. My mom doesn't even look 45. You can't tell me. You can't. Yeah, you can make fun of me for the numbers stuff and the nerd stuff. I don't look remotely 45.
Wow, that really, really hit a nerve there.
Nah,
I love it.
Nah.
There will be more where that came
from. We just can't have the audience think I'm 45.
Blake's not 45.
No, he's 39. That's still 39. Old. Still old. But here's the important line, though. I'm on the right side of the Max Scherzer line where there's still one Blue Jay who's older than me. I have lost that in basketball where Garrett Temple was the oldest Raptor this year, and he is 3 days younger than me.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so they...
3 days?
Yes, 3 days. And he was a regular on the show, so him and Matt would always... Matt Bonner, my co-host, would always go back and forth about the age jokes, and I'm just like sitting there quietly, like low key, three days older than Garrett Temple.
The Raptors were a team that got pretty young in recent years, right?
As sort of also like no one process. Is older. Like there's like LeBron and Kyle Lowry and Chris Paul. I think those are the only three left that are older than me. Basketball.
Time is weird. We're still here, though.
This is why, thank goodness for Charlie Morton. We'll be fine on the baseball side for a long time. Let's go from talking about old guys to
talking about college age pitchers.
Sure.
Avoided tripping on something weird. Okay.
Something.
The
yes.
Men's College World Series, which we have talked about a little bit over the course of the last couple of weeks, concluded yesterday. Mm-hmm. LSU wins their second national championship in the last 3 years and their eighth overall. Some heartbreak along the way for Arkansas. Some fun stuff from a prospect perspective. We got to see a couple guys who could hear their names in the first round, maybe even in the top 10 in the case. In the case of Cade Anderson, if you listen to his coach, maybe he should be in the conversation for number one. I don't know how the Holiday family feel about that, but maybe you could push for number two. We'll not go down there because Jake Mintz is back now, but Jake Mintz was in Nebraska for a little bit of that. Let's take a break. Let's talk to him on the other side as JSTOC Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. It's Monday morning for everyone, apparently.
You're so mean.
I mean, what? Everyone can make fun of me for having a Monday morning? I can't. I'm not even naming names. Just letting everyone know that it's Monday morning for a lot of people over here. I assume Jake Mintz is in better form than I am. Let's talk to him. Of Yahoo Sports, of Cespedes Family Barbecue. He joins us now. What's up, man? How you doing?
I'm doing wonderfully. It is hot and hotter here in New York City this morning, but I woke up on the correct side of the bed today.
There you go.
It's hot here too, man.
Yeah, a lot going on. A lot going on this Monday morning. We are so glad that that you're in better shape than us, Jake, because this is the last segment. We are, you know, running a little bit out of steam. So time to talk some Men's College World Series. First of all, just what was the experience like for you? You were there, right? I know you weren't there for the final, but just wondering how much fun you had being in that environment for a little bit.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite events of the year. I have been each of the last four seasons now, and it's just a really unique event. There are two games every day, right? And so when you are making the time to go, you get double the baseball. You get these eight different fan bases from across the country in the States coming to this very singular point in Omaha, where it's essentially a celebration of baseball. And the teams this year were a little bit different. Usually the SEC, the Southeastern Conference, kind of dominates the proceedings. They only had two teams in Omaha this year, although one of them did end up winning, LSU. There was a little bit more parity this season than we've seen in years past in college baseball. But as far as the event goes, it's great. And the thing I actually really love about college baseball that I would encourage people to look for next year is that they're worse. So, like, more stuff can happen. If you're watching a Jays game and there's a ground ball to second base, you kind of just tune out the second the ball's put in play, right? Because they are worse, the fewer plays get made. Very little is ever routine. The game is kind of always in the balance because of this. And they're really talented. So they're still hitting the ball 400 feet and they're still throwing 97. It's just that not every play gets made.
Yeah, it's interesting. It feels similar to basketball. Like, I cover NBA basketball as well, and then you tune into NCAA tournaments. Some people like it better. You know, I don't know. There are other reasons for it. The basketball is unquestionably not better, but so much more stuff can happen. It's a little richer on stories. It sometimes feels like it means a lot more. And as a small drawback, the referees and umpires are not always of the Major League or NBA caliber. We got a bit of an ump show in the deciding game of the College World Series. Coastal Carolina's coach and I believe first base coach getting ejected for basically nothing. What'd you make of this one? And the comment after of I'm responsible for a lot of stuff. I'm not responsible for the umpire's lack of athleticism. Great chirp on the way out.
Absolutely good stuff. I mean, so just to be clear, Kevin Schnall, the head coach of Coastal Carolina, gets the heave-ho. And then in the aftermath, one of the other umpires runs over, kind of trips over his own feet. And it looks, because of the camera angle, like the head coach pushed him or bumped him. And that was very much not the case. So to get that shot out on the way was very funny. I will say, by the letter of the law, this was the correct move, right? To throw Kevin Shaw out of the game. You're not supposed to argue balls on strikes. And so the umpire within the rule book was correct. But here's the thing, my dear friends. We do not always live life inside the rule book. If that was the case, we would always be pulled over for speeding on the highway every day. Okay? Here in America, where the drinking age is 18, no one on college campuses would be imbibing alcohol. There are parts of society where there is a little touch and feel in regards to how we choose to implement the rule book. And in this particular instance, deciding to eject the head coach in the first inning of an elimination game for something that didn't seem too egregious was egregious in and of itself.
Yeah, like I don't want to come out here and say instant karma, but if that was indeed the ump show, maybe the show was Three Stooges. I don't know. It was just so bizarre. And listen, you know, obviously LSU ends up winning, which is not completely unexpected. This is their second in 3 years. It is interesting. You mentioned the parity there, Jake, and it's like, okay, they were ranked number six, but clearly they are, you know, as close to a powerhouse as you can get. With
only Little Rock can beat them.
Exactly. Does that sort of, you know, point to the parity that you were talking about? How does the seeding even, you know, play a factor into this?
So I would say that any team that is ranked is what's called a national host. Mm. So those are the top eight teams in the country get to host the regional and super regional rounds, effectively the first two rounds of the tournament. If any of those teams win, they're usually not an underdog. Those are the favorites, right? That's kind of the upper crust of college baseball. LSU is firmly in that group. The thing about this season that was a little bit different is just where the teams came from. So of the eight teams in Omaha, you had Super Cinderella Murray State, which was a four seed. For people that don't know the way that it's ranked, you have 64 teams in the tournament. They are broken up into 16 four-team buckets. So you end up with one, two, threes, and four seeds. Murray State was the only four seed to reach the Men's College World Series this year. They're only the fourth four seed in the history of this current format to do so. So they were the Super Cinderella. But beyond them, you had Oregon State, who is playing as an independent after getting booted from the Pac-12 RIP. You had Arizona, who is coming out of the Big 10. Excuse me, the Big 12. You had UCLA, who was coming out of the Big 10. You had one ACC school, which was very odd, with just Louisville being the rep from the ACC. And then two SEC schools with Arkansas and LSU. And then Coastal Carolina being kind of this kind of mid-major powerhouse. Usually, I believe last year, we had four ACC and four SEC schools. Now, I do think that the balance of power in college baseball and collegiate athletics as a whole is going to continue to skew towards money, right? If you have the money to go get talented players in the transfer portal using NIL, that's going to help you win baseball games, football games, basketball games, equestrian, whatever. You get my point. I think that baseball is the most impervious to that dynamic simply because of how random the sport is and how dependent it is on that day's starting pitcher and how in a playoff format, you lose two games and you're done. You play a 55 game regular season. You have two bad afternoons at the ball yard and it's, you know, it's summer vacation. And so because of that, I think there will be an element of parity that is embedded in the sport. And I generally think that that's a good thing.
Yeah. Murray State is a great one. Shout out to Popeye Jones, former Toronto Raptor, and AEW wrestler Chuck Taylor. Those are the two big, I mean, John Morant too, but everyone knows John Morant. Those are the only Murray State people that I know. So there was also on LSU's way, Jake, and you mentioned you can't assume a ground ball to second base is going to get played smoothly. You can't assume X run lead is safe. And you had a great bit on the show last week about being in the dugout after Arkansas blew it against LSU. I know you've talked about this a little bit already. Can you tell us a little bit about what that scene was like in the dugout and just kind of how that field, how that felt for you being a part of that and getting to tell that story?
Yeah. So just the context here, Arkansas, they're essentially like the Chicago Cubs of college baseball, where they are probably the best team to have never won a national championship, right up there with North Carolina and Florida State. And in 2018, they were winning in the bottom of the ninth of the last game and with two outs, and there was a pop-up down the right field line that was not caught. Oregon State storms back, wins that game, wins the next day, and it's like, wow, they were one pop-up away from a national championship, but they couldn't do it. This was a little bit different. They needed to beat LSU twice in order to move on to the finals, but they're winning 5-3 in the ninth inning with one out and nobody on base, and they end up kind of letting the game slowly unravel away for them. The dramatic moment is a line drive off the shoulder of left fielder Charles Davalon that kind of squirts away, and LSU ties the game and wins it on the next batter, eliminating Arkansas from the Men's College World Series. And the aftermath of it was a tidal wave of emotion. And I think the reason that you see these emotions in baseball, and this is true in softball as well, is the timing of the tournament in the college year. So when you're a senior and you lose in this fashion, it's not just that your college career is over and the season is over. It's that your childhood is over. Like, adulthood kicks in, right? And when you're a college athlete, your whole life is kind of prescribed. It's wake up at this time, lift at that time, eat at this time, practice at that time, study, depending on your school, at this time, right? And when you're done, that roadmap just kind of goes out the window and the future becomes murkier and hazier for you. And that's really scary. And this all kind of comes rushing in at one single moment. And for Charles Davalon, who's going to be probably a late first, second round pick this year, the mystery for him is just where will he go play professional baseball? And that's great. But it was this really striking moment to see the Arkansas players on the bench crying. There's so much more crying in college baseball, which I am a fan of. I think A League of Their Own set overly macho men back 25 years. I think there should be crying in all instances of life. But you have all these Arkansas dudes crying on the bench. You have their parents behind them in the stands kind of consoling them and watching over them. And then you have kids run the bases night at the stadium. And so you have, you know, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds running out onto the field. And you have the Arkansas players looking at their past, their younger selves of what they once were and their parents behind them. And it was just this beautiful kind of cycle of baseball moment that even though there is a lot of loss and despair, usually what people remember are the good things, those kids running the bases type moments, because that is kind of the fan in all of us and where we fall in love with the sport to begin with.
This is that's really well said, and thank you for sharing that. This is an Arkansas related question, but it is less on the touching side. I'm just curious, the Aloy brothers from Hawaii who were on Arkansas. So it's funny. So Bobby Webster, the general manager of the Toronto Raptors, is Hawaiian, and because of that, I weirdly just always have my eye on Hawaiian guys because, you know, I think Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, like new Bobby Webster. There's like a fraternity of Hawaiian people in the four major pro sports. Max Holloway in the UFC is kind of in there as well. So just curious, I know you had written up Vaheva as like a name to watch in your 10 prospects coming out of it. What is their outlook from here? And I guess just how cool is it to have a pair of Hawaiian brothers be one of the biggest stories of a pocket of the College World Series?
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I dove a little bit deep onto the world of Hawaii baseball, and it's such an interesting baseball culture because they have these distinct competitive advantages. It's hot all the time, right? It's easy to practice. And these distinct competitive disadvantages, they're isolated geographically, and so they don't get to play travel ball in the same way where like a kid from Texas can get in the car and drive to Mississippi or Louisiana and play a game, right? They don't have the same level of access to equipment where a bag of balls is more expensive over there because of the shipping costs. And there's something of a brain drain where the best coaches and players who can make it to the mainland will often stay and not bring that talent and that information back with them. That's been changing over the last 10 years or so. And the Aloy brothers are kind of the output of those efforts alongside Iva Arquette, who is the starting shortstop for Oregon State, who will probably be a top five, top 10 pick in this draft. It's just cool to see a specific baseball culture that is unique, right? Because I think the isolation creates a resourcefulness in a lot of the Hawaiian players that is different, that is separate, that does distinguish itself. And I think we saw that this year with the Aloy brothers and with Iva Arquette. Now, as far as pro prospect status goes, I would prefer to draft Arquette. I'm a little bit lower on Vihiva Aloy, I think, than maybe where the industry's at, just because I think there's a lot of swing and miss and a lot of chase. But I think it's important to appreciate the stories of these players and their accomplishments in college. Vihiva Aloy just won the Golden Spikes Award for the best player in college baseball without being like, oh, yeah, sure, he did this, but he's never going to hit in pro ball. Like, both of those things can be true, and I think we have to hold them in our minds at the same time.
It's that is fascinating. I love sort of watching or experiencing baseball culture elsewhere. Like, if you watch a game in Korea, if you watch a game in Japan, it looks like I get a lot of TikToks now of Japanese baseball, which is great. And it's different, right? It's clearly different. It's still the same game, but there's an identity there that is so there. Same goes for Latin American countries and things of the sort. And I'm wondering if that's kind of what you're seeing here, Jake, where it's like, yeah, it's still the same game, obviously, but or the distinctions that you see within the sport, in the batter's box or whatever it may be for Hawaiian guys.
Yeah, I mean, I would say there's a bigger emphasis. I don't really know how to tab it at the big league level necessarily. It's a lot more infielders than it is outfielders. It's a lot more guys who tend to be more physical in the infield. I do think it. You run the risk when you like be like, oh, all of these players from this place are like this, and all of these players from this place are like that. But I do think that there are some unique differences. So, like, one example is so the kid who dropped the fly ball for Arkansas is a Canadian kid from Montreal, Charles Davalon. And a lot of the Canadian kids, because it's colder and they can't play year round, tend to be more physical at a younger age. Think Tyler O'Neill, right? It's like, oh, I can't get outside. Well, I'm going to go hit the weight room and I'm going to be a more finished product from a physicality standpoint when I reach the big league. So that is one example, I think, of just kind of how the specifics of your location impact your personal development. And then there's obviously, like, you know, I grew up in DC. No one threw above 85 miles an hour. None of us could hit. Like, it's better to be in Florida, Georgia, or California, or Texas, because you can play all the time.
Yeah, that makes sense. And yeah, Davalon, better days ahead. We'll hope that he'll shake that one off. Okay.
I'm a believer, dude.
Okay,
I'm
good.
A big believer in that guy. Like,
good.
If you want to keep an eye on him, it's kind of like a baby Jaren Duran type vibe, where he's like this really short, like, stocky, physical dude with a lot of backside power. Yeah, he's like 5'8", maybe. It's like if it's Corbin Carroll physicality. He's not that level of player. That's not what I'm saying. Let me be very clear about that. But it's similar to Jaren Duran's game. If Davalon can stick in center, I think he has a chance to be a really, really good big leaguer for a really long time.
Nice. It's interesting that, like, yeah, some of the Canadian prospects, there's an undersized strength, because Emelian Petri from Kentucky last year was well, like, a similarly undersized guy. Okay, so Jake, you were at the College World Series. I know you guys are keeping an eye on this throughout the year. Jordan's down at the Combine. What is the process now to create the BBQ top 50?
So we love the draft. We think it is fascinating. We think it is something that more fans hopefully will get into over time. It's difficult, right, because of the time gap between when these guys are getting drafted and when they're showing up in the big leagues, compared to, you know, football and basketball. There's much longer of a wait. Paul Skeens obviously is something of an aberration there, but I've really enjoyed this year kind of working on the list with Jordan. Typically he runs point on that. He went and did the combine. This time of year, we're kind of asking around the industry, trying to get a sense of which talented high school kids are expected to sign and which talented kids are expected to go to college at this point. It's like, oh, well, a team would be willing to pay that guy this amount. How much money does that guy want to forego his commitment to Georgia or Texas or whatever the heck, right? Now, I'm more so looking at the college side of things, particularly hitters. And the three main things I'm looking for when I'm evaluating a guy are, do they stay at an up-the-middle position, right? Can they play shortstop or center field? or do they need to move to a corner? What do they look like in the box? Is it explosive? Is their bat quick? Do I think the power is going to play at the big league level? Are they twitchy? And then the last one is, what are their swing rate decision-making stuff look like, right? Are they overly passive? Are they swinging through fastballs in the strike zone? Are they chasing sliders outside of the strike zone? Because typically that's the type of stuff that's the most set when a player enters pro ball, are chase and in zone contact. And a lot of teams nowadays would rather take a player that makes a lot of contact in the zone with less power, and they think that they can help a guy kind of get that over the fence juice once they get a little older and more physical. So those are the three main things that we're looking at right now when we build our draft list. It's a very interesting year for the draft. There is no generational talent at the top. There's a really exciting kind of top eight, top 10 guys, but I don't think there's anyone on like the Paul Skeens level. And that is true, even though LSU has a kid who might go number one in Cade Anderson, who just threw a 130 pitch complete game in the College World Series. He still is not quite what Paul was. And that's okay. Not every year is going to have a generational talent. That's why they're generational talents.
Yeah. We've spoken about quite a few of the top end names, right? And obviously we can maybe put Gage Wood in there, Cade Anderson, as well, as you said. In your research and your observations, has there been anyone that maybe is flying a bit under the radar and is someone that we should keep an eye on?
So flying under the radar, so let me start who I would take number one.
Yep.
Now, this is not my job. I do not get paid to do this. Okay. I would take Eli Willits first overall, who is a high school shortstop coming out of Oklahoma. His dad, Reggie Willits, is a coach at the University of Oklahoma. His older brother, Jackson Willits, played there. He reclassified, so he was originally supposed to be in the 2026 class. He kind of went ahead of grade, and so now he's much younger for the class. He's been, like, playing in Oklahoma fall ball scrimmages since he was, like, 13 or 14. I just think that if you're looking at the overall athleticism, the overall package, Willits is probably the most – I think he's the best player available. Now, if you're looking for someone who's a little bit under the radar in the high school ranks, I really like Gavin Fien, who is a third baseman who I think can really hit. I mentioned Davalon before. I'm a big Davalon fan. And then the dude who I kind of have fallen in love with over the last couple of weeks is Coastal Carolina catcher Caden Bodine. It's a very unique profile. Switch hitting catcher. Elite defensive skills, elite contact skills, questions about if he's going to grow into enough power at the big league level. But for me, it's like if I have a catcher who's putting up a 265, 270 batting average and handling a staff, that's a big leaguer for a long time. And if the power comes, it comes. Now, it just depends on what your organization is looking for. Are you going to draft a little bit more safe? Are you going to be a little bit more aggressive? You know, we've seen organizations like the Padres only take high school guys. And sometimes they turn into Jackson Merrill, and sometimes you don't know what they turn into, right? So, yeah, all in all, very interesting year for the draft. I believe it will be 2 days before the All-Star game in Atlanta. So make sure everyone keeps an eye on that.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, hey, switch hitting defense first catcher, you're talking my language. I will believe in that guy until he's 35 and on like his ninth year of AAA ball. And the nice thing about Eli Willits is you'll get to remember some guys and the fact that his dad stole 27 bases 1 year. Angels legend, Reggie Willits. That's always great. This is always great. Jake, thanks so much for doing this, man.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jake Mintz, Yahoo Sports, the Barbie cast over there, Cespedes Family Barbecue. Yeah, Reggie Willits. This is it's not quite the son of CC Sabathia, right? Is in the draft, yeah. Level feeling old. But yeah, Reggie, that was 2007 when he stole 27 bags. So Angels, I guess that makes legend. Sense. He would be 44 years old now.
Yeah, there's always that chance though with the draft, right? There's kids of former big leaguers popping up left, right, and center, and it does give us a chance to look back a little bit and fish for some baseball reference pages, yeah, that we had long forgotten.
Yeah, there are a few of those in the NBA draft, which I'll be doing a show on a little later this week. Oh yeah, I guess I could do that programming note. So yeah. I don't know. I'm here Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday. You'll be with Show Ali on Thursday, yeah, because Wednesday night I'll be doing a NBA draft show version of the Raptors show as well. The Raptors have the number 9 and 39 pick. Although the number 39 pick will come Thursday. This is they've done an awkward thing, like content-wise, splitting the draft in two nights. Better for a fan, better for front offices. A little awkward if you're doing a post-draft show after only one round.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not much you can do about
Make
that.
Make sure to, you know, take advantage of it. Sleep in on Thursday. Come back refreshed.
I'm not a sleeping guy, even when I, like...
Really?
Yeah.
You can't sleep in.
Nah. It's just, I'm not a sleep guy in general. Yeah, I'm not a big sleeper. Like, it'd be, like, a miracle if I slept past, like, 8:30 in the morning.
Wow.
It and I'm a late night guy, too.
Yeah.
Candle at both ends, you know?
I wish. Yeah.
Fortunately.
It's Monday, you know? I'm thinking about sleep a lot.
Yes. So normally I would say, unfortunately, no Jays game today because I don't like off days. I want a game to talk about. I want a game to watch. But coming off that White Sox series, we'll say fortunately one extra day of reprieve. We will be back tomorrow to set up the Guardians series. Thank you to Jeremy Machino and Jake Mintz for joining us. Thanks to all of you for the text line questions. Thanks to Amit Mon, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Olnick behind the glass. Have a wonderful Monday.